Hi, everybody. Welcome to Well Nurse, your go-to podcast for all things wellness and nursing. As a nurse, you dedicate your time and energy to caring for others, but it's equally important to prioritize your own well-being. Join us as we explore practical tips, inspiring stories, and expert insights to help you enhance your physical, mental, and emotional health. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Well Nurse. I'm Joey Travis, and I have Dana Morrison with me today. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Joey.
How's it going?
It's going good. I'm really excited.
Yeah, today's guest is one of my favorite. We have Dr. Suzanne Judd. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so Dr. Suzanne Judd, she is the director of Lister Hill Center for Health Policy, and she is a professor at the UAB School of Public Health. She has a PhD in nutrition sciences. She is also a PI on two large epidemiology studies here at UAB, both with NIH funding. Her research focus is on the role of diet and the environment as mediators of racial disparities in the risk of hypertension, kidney disease, and stroke.
Yeah, Dr. Judd is somebody we've had a conversation with multiple times. She does a lot of our nursing leadership calls, and she's always a fan favorite, if you will. So we're doing a little bit of a Q&A with her today, and we had the opportunity to actually ask our bedside nurses for input and questions. Every time we're around Dr. Judd, I'm always so impressed because I feel like she just has so much knowledge that is just ready to go. She wasn't briefed on any of these questions, full disclaimer. We just asked and she fired away with the answers. We found it really insightful and we are hopeful that you will too. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Dr. Judd. All right, Dr. Judd, thank you so much for doing this for us. We know our listeners will be so grateful for all your insights, but we're going to start with the basics when we do a little Q&A. What's the right amount of water that we need on a daily basis?
Ooh, that's tricky. So the right amount of water really depends partially on your genetics, you know, how much you sweat. If you sweat a lot, you need more water. If you consume diuretics like coffee or alcohol, you need more water. If it's hot, you need more water. So it's not a one size fits all answer. But in general, the 8 glasses a day is a pretty good benchmark. And then you can add on as you think about, you know, how much you're sweating, whether it's hot outside, if you do drink coffee in the morning, all of those things are going to make it so you need more water than the standard 8 glasses a day.
As a nurses, we're working at the bedside, we're consumed with all different kinds of stuff. We're worried about the intake of our patients, but not ourselves. What's a practical way to make sure we're hitting those marks?
So one way you can do it is to bring a big water bottle that's got your whole 64 ounces for that day, the whole 8 glasses right there in the bottle. And you can see all day long how you're consuming it, because it's really best to do it a little bit at a time. You don't want to drink the whole 8 glasses, obviously, at one time. So having that 64 ounces that you take in every day can help you to watch out for it. You can also build it into your day with, you know, smart habits that say, okay, every time I go past this drinking fountain, I'm going to get a glass of water. Or whenever I go back to the computer to enter paperwork, I'm going to get a drink of water. So you can build it into your day specifically around your activities as well, so that it becomes one of those small habits that you're doing regularly. But you're right. It's tough when you're running around from room to room and patient to patient to remember to get water. Even though you're helping them stay hydrated, it can be difficult. So if you can find a way to build it into your normal day, whether it's that big bottle of water or, you know, really specific times, okay, I know when I go past this drinking fountain, I'm going to grab a drink, that can help you to stay hydrated.
We do see a lot of products that are kind of marketed toward like water additives that increase hydration. Are those legit?
They are. They're absolutely legit. You know, they started in the sports field. It's a pretty well-known story about Florida and Gatorade, where it was so hot and muggy that they had to find a way to keep the athletes hydrated, and straight water wouldn't do it. So it is true, especially in those situations where you're becoming extremely hydrated, that adding salts to your water and a little bit of glucose can make you more hydrated. It absorbs better. So yes, it's true that adding things to your water, makes it more palatable. There are people out there that hate the taste of water. So the you know, little sports packets can make it taste a little bit better. So you drink the water. The key is to make sure it doesn't have too much sugar, because you're probably also worried about your weight and making sure that you don't get too much sugar throughout the day. So you'll want to seek one out that does not have a ton of sugar in it. But then after that, just a little bit of salt. Really, it's sodium, potassium, magnesium. Those are the salts that help you to stay hydrated. Helps to keep the water in your body instead of just going right to your kidneys and then, you know, out your bladder and it's gone. So they are helpful. You don't have to buy expensive sports drinks, though. You can actually hydrate yourself. You can put just a little bit of salt in there. You know, like a sea salt is a little bit better than a table salt because of the iodine that's in table salt. Typical table salt you'd find in the store, but you can just put a little bit of that in there with like just a little, you know, half teaspoon of maple syrup, and you can really create your own, a little bit of lemon. So you don't have to make a really expensive drink if adding of those packets winds up getting costly. That's in health, we're always trying to balance the perfect with the expensive and what tastes good. You know, it's constantly a balance.
And kind of playing off of that, we've heard a lot about the recent increase in food pricing. Do you have any tips or tricks to help us save money out here?
Yeah, food is. It's a lot more expensive, especially staples like milk and meat. I mean, those have really gone up to make things more expensive. As much as you can prepare for yourself, if you have the time, that helps you to save money. Buying in bulk, you know, maybe make a large meal that would feed you over 3 or 4 days, and you can put it in the freezer and have, you know, ready-made lunches that you can take to work that week. That will help to save money. Trying not to eat out because eating out is going to be more expensive than eating at home. Other tips and tricks involve being very mindful about the food you eat and the timing that you're eating it, to make sure that you don't get overly hungry. We all, when we get overly hungry, can make bad decisions where we say, okay, I don't care that this whatever it is, sandwich costs $15, I'm going to buy it anyway. So making sure that you're staying on top of your hunger so you don't make decisions in a fit of starvation can also help to save money.
So if we are able to meal prep, is there a big difference between eating meal prepped or microwave food versus eating fresh food?
So not really small, negligible difference. It really depends on how it's been cooked. If you took the fresh food and you really cooked it down in the cooking process, you know, boiled the color out of the broccoli, you do get fewer nutrients, but in terms of the next day, whatever you cooked is going to be roughly the same as what it was the day before. Certainly, fresh has, especially fresh and raw, you're going to have more intact micronutrients, but it's just such a small negligible difference that I always have to laugh when people say, oh, you have to do it this way or you have to do it that way. Sure, you might get a few more micronutrients, but if that's prohibiting you from eating them because it's so hard to work with raw food, you know, what's the big deal of cooking it? It's only changing the nutritional composition a tiny amount.
And how about when it comes to, speaking of vegetables, how about when it comes to things like buying organic? Is that worth the cost?
In some cases, yes, it is worth the cost, especially for foods that are really high in pesticides. And you can find a list of what's called the Dirty Dozen, the foods that are most commonly treated for pesticides, that it's better than to buy organic because you can get a lot of those pesticides in your body and they can build up over time. But it's really a sensible approach. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. You don't have to be 100% organic. Foods that you peel, like avocados and bananas, that helps to get that outer layer of pesticide off. And what's inside has fewer pesticides than what would be on the outside. Fruits like blueberries, raspberries, those are almost impossible to peel. So those are the ones you may want to try for organic if your budget can afford it. But if it can't, soak them in soap and water, and that helps to rinse the pesticides off the outside. So, you know, again, you don't want to try to be perfect all the time, because sometimes it just gets so expensive, and then you might never eat the raspberries and blueberries. It's more important to eat a raspberry or a blueberry, even if it's not grown organically, and just give it a good rinse than it is to avoid it altogether because you don't think you can afford the organic version.
And how about for those of us who might not cook? How can we try to eat healthy, per se, if we don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen?
Yeah, absolutely. So your best bet is to start with what we were just talking about, some fruit. If you can just work some raw fruit into your diet, particularly the berries, because they're shown to be so beneficial to the brain. Finding a way to get those berries in your diet, and then nuts are another really good something you don't have to cook. Walnuts, peanuts, macadamia nuts, whatever it is, the type of nut that you like, pecans, try to work some of those into your diet, preferably not overly sweetened and salted. You know, you can get some pretty delicious nut mixes this time of year, but they're not the healthiest because they've been covered in sugar and cinnamon that makes them taste so good. But at the same time, you're adding calories to the diet. So those are a couple of really easy things that don't need a lot of prep, and you can just work them into your snacks to get some healthier options. And then you can go with whatever you go with after that, whether it's buying lunch in the cafeteria, bringing in those microwave meals that came out of the freezer, at least you know that you've worked in some good nutrients through your snacking on fruit and nuts.
So we hear a lot about how much we're eating. So we like 3 meals a day, some, you know, if we're trying to load up on macros and gain weight, 5 meals a day. I like to graze. That's a confession. What is is there a specific healthy time of day that we should be eating, a certain number of meals we should be eating? Is it okay to have something we can graze on all day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So really, this is one where I think that the popular press and also, you know, nutrition books have confused people, because you'll hear eat 6 times a day. No, don't eat only twice a day. It really kind of this back and forth argument. What we know is that you need to spend some portion of your day fasted. It's good for your insulin, for you to take a break from eating at some point, hopefully 12 hours. That's the goal. If you can hit 12 hours of not eating from the time you go to bed until the time you wake up in the morning, that gives your body the chance for it to go into a state where you're not consuming a lot of sugar. So your insulin and glucagon processes can, you know, they can work together to optimize your blood sugar. So it's beneficial in terms of how your body processes sugar to take that small window off. Some people argue it needs to be 16 hours long. Some people, you know, argue even more. But truthfully, 12 hours is plenty of time without eating for you to your body to rest and restore and do the things that it needs to do. Then once you're in this that 12 hour eating range, I always tell people whatever works for you. You know, Joey, if you can eat, you know, grazing all day long and maintain your weight, do it. And you don't feel bad and you're okay, do what works for you. On the other hand, you know, Dana, if you say no way, if I ate all day long, I'd gain weight and I would never feel full, then don't eat all day long. Eat 3 square meals and that's all that you do. It's really, this is where you have to think about your own metabolism and what works for you, and then not overthink your diet too much. Same thing is true if meals are social. Let's say that every night, you know, that there's going to be a big meal with your family or you go out to dinner with friends regularly, do it. Keep that in your routine, because you don't want to lose the social parts of food, but then make sure earlier in the day you're eating a little bit less to compensate for what you want to eat that night.
We have this restaurant in town and I have a food truck and they make acai bowls.
Oh yeah.
We probably know the restaurant, but mm-hmm. They're marketed as like a superfood. What does that mean? What are some other options that are superfoods?
Superfoods really have some type of non-calorie or micronutrient like vitamin component to it that helps you with long-term health. Most superfoods are basically antioxidants. That's if you break it down and look at what that means, it really are just different types of antioxidants. And the way that you can tell that a food has a lot of antioxidant is the color. So antioxidants tend to be very bright in color. The very things that make them colorful also are the things that help you to have less inflammation in your body. So acai is this beautiful bright purple shade, and that helps to provide some inflammatory benefit in your body. Lots of fancy words that go with it that describe what exactly those antioxidants are. But at the end of the day, a superfood is just something that when you take it in, it helps to calm the inflammation in your body, which in the long run makes you feel better. And acai definitely has it in there, but so do blueberries. They're also bright in color. Raspberries, grapefruit. You can find lots of foods that are very bright in color. The green vegetables, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, collards, all of those really bright greens. Those colors actually, again, correspond to the antioxidants that reduce inflammation in your body. So all of those foods can help you if you're trying to find a way to work superfoods into your diet.
We just had this cool study that UAB participated in with Vanderbilt that made a lot of national press about salt intake. What do we know about the importance of diet right now in regards to longevity and disease reduction?
We know diet and physical activity are among the two most important things that people can do, aside from not smoking. Obviously, not smoking is the first. But now, with the smoking rates being so much lower than they used to be, it really is diet and physical activity. And we know that there are different, compounds in food that can either enhance your life expectancy or decrease your life expectancy. And salt is one of those that's very heavily studied. For some people, eating too much salt really causes a problem. It raises their blood pressure and leads to adverse outcomes. It's not a one-size-fits-all equation, just like we were talking about with eating small meals versus large meals. It's highly personal and really dependent upon what your biochemistry is. If your blood pressure is really low, 90 over 50, it probably isn't going to hurt you to eat a little bit extra salt in your diet. But most Americans do not suffer from extremely low blood pressure. So that study you saw with UAB and Vanderbilt, it showed that pretty much everybody, if you decrease the amount of salt that you eat, you wind up with a decrease in blood pressure up to about 8 milliliters of mercury. So certainly salt is one of those things. Another one of those nutrients in food that causes problems is trans fat. Although we don't see many trans fats in diet anymore, there used to be a lot of trans fats in things like margarine and cooking oils, and those trans fats were associated with a lot of heart disease. Now, when you're looking at fats, it's the saturated fats you've got to watch out for to see, it's not that a little bit is bad, it's just getting too much of that saturated fat might again lead to heart disease depending on your genetic makeup. So food certainly matters, and it's something people have to watch out for, but you really have to know within yourself too, what are the foods that you should stay away from and what are foods that are okay for you to eat.
Pulling up, we talked about fats. I hear a lot about tracking macros. That's a common term thrown out there. Do you recommend that, like, the average person track their macros? Is that something we should all be aware of?
Average person, no. If you are looking for specific fitness goals or you're trying to lose weight, tracking macros is a great way to try to make that happen. It's tracking macros became the new tracking calories, because if you're tracking your carbohydrates and protein, you're basically tracking your calories. But it, every year we have these new ways to repackage what we know about getting people to eat a little bit less. With one caveat, I will say a lot of people do not eat enough protein. So sometimes all they have to do is track protein and try to make sure that they get enough protein every day. And that helps them with just feeling a little bit more energy, may help to lose some stubborn weight, especially if they wind up cutting back on carbohydrates or fat because they've increased their protein. So that's one is it, as you're aging too, we often don't get enough protein as we age. So that's one macro that people sometimes track.
Okay, and speaking of protein, is there a general guideline? Like, how much should we eat?
There are many general guidelines because people have different protein guidelines depending on what you're trying to do. It's in terms of the average person, roughly 0.6 grams per kilogram is a reasonable amount. But who knows what that means? That confuses people when they have to calculate their body weight and then figure out protein. If you can hit roughly 70-ish grams of protein per day on the low end, up to about 200 if you're trying to be a bodybuilder and really put on mass, that will get you in the right range. For myself, I try to hit 25 grams of protein in each meal. I don't track it crazily, but I do kind of in my head think, okay, did you have protein with this meal? It's the hardest one for me to track. I'm not as good about eating protein as I am other things like carbohydrates and fat.
Dr. Judd, we live in a world of bad diets that are kind of elevated, for lack of better words, because of maybe social media. We have keto, we have a lot of intermittent fasting. What are some that there are maybe some truth behind, or what are some that we should stay away from?
We do live in a world of fad diets. You'll get a new diet book every couple of years, and they make money. It's a money-making industry, not rooted terribly in science. It's really, it truly is just a money-making industry as these new diets come out. Then they can wind up with foods that are branded with their label. So they can really wind up making a lot of money from a new diet. At the end of the day, we really do know what works. It's just really very simple energy in, energy out. the big difference is you also have to feel full. I think that one of the things we didn't understand really up until some of these new drugs came out that helped to curb hunger, that what role hunger plays in terms of people feeling satisfied and able to adhere to a specific diet. You know, you have to balance those weight loss goals, which means cutting back on maybe carbohydrates, increasing protein, cutting back on calories. You have to balance that with feeling full and feeling satisfied and going about your daily life. So the challenge with saying one, you know, perfect diet and why you constantly see these fad diets is that they always are designed to kind of reprogram your hunger and also still help you lose weight. But again, at the end of the day, it's really simple. Cut back a little. And by a little, I mean, just a fraction, 10% of what you're currently doing, increase your activity and you'll start to see those, the weight fall off. It doesn't have to be massive.
Keto was a hot topic for the past few years. Can you explain what that ketoacidosis, what's actually going on in our body?
Yeah, absolutely. So the body prefers sugar for fuel. It's the preferred source. Your brain prefers sugar. Your muscles prefer sugar. It's the compound the body really likes for energy. Well, keto is a byproduct of fat when your body uses fat for energy. And when your body uses fat for energy, it lives on these ketone bodies that produces or puts you into ketosis. The brain can use ketones really effectively. And in some folks, as they age, those ketones are actually a little bit better for the brain than sugar. So you're seeing a lot of people starting to talk about ketogenic diets and the benefits as we age. When you're young and you're growing, there's not nearly as much benefit other than weight loss from a ketogenic diet because of the fact that you're burning fat when you go into ketosis. But it really, again, this is one of those things that is going to be highly personal. There's a whole new body of literature that's showing the genetics of people who respond well to ketogenic diets. Not surprisingly, it's men. Men typically respond much better to ketogenic diets than women do. And you hear that anecdotally where you hear someone say, oh yeah, my husband and I went on keto together. He lost 30 pounds and the wife might say, I only lost 10. We're starting to understand that there are some sex differences in terms of how these diets affect people. So, you know, you have to be really careful with them when you think about it. You'll lose weight on a ketogenic diet, that there's no doubt, but you have to decide if it's really the right one for you. And if you start to see a plateau, maybe it's better to go back on a diet that's got some sugar in it, that it might actually help you to get to the next level.
Do we have a lot of evidence about how we metabolize, say, prescription drugs, since we're changing the way our body's metabolizing things? Is there a lot that's, you know, if we're taking a blood pressure or a cholesterol pill, is that going to alter those responses at all to how we process that drug?
Absolutely. You will see a slight modification. Certain foods like grapefruit can also modify how you metabolize drugs. So that is a factor. And the way that you eat can also be a factor, particularly if you cut way back on what you eat, your liver has more of a chance to process the drug. So you may have to change the dose in your medication. That's something that folks listening can talk to their doctor if they start to think that they're more sensitive to their medication when they start to go on a diet. The drugs themselves, especially statins, they actually impact the way your body interacts with your diet. So when you take a statin and you consume a lot of saturated fat, you're not as likely to turn that saturated fat into cholesterol. So the drugs themselves can also impact the way that your body handles the food you eat.
Another thing we wanted to touch on, just being in the nursing world, one thing that wrecked my diet was being on night shift for a few years. So for those of us that are on night shift, is there anything that we should prioritize as far as nutrition?
The first thing, you're going to laugh at this, but the first thing you should prioritize is stress reduction. Because being on night shift actually causes flips in that serotonin, melatonin response in your body, which leads to elevated stress. So when you're on an altered shift, you want to try to prioritize stress reduction wherever you can, whether that's 5 minutes of meditation, some breathing exercises, trying to find some routine. Start with the reducing stress first, because one of the things we're learning more and more about is things like sleep deprivation, which happens when you're on a back shift. leads to increased stress, which changes your eating habits because you start to crave different types of food. So the first step is stress reduction. And then the second step is diet. You probably want to pay even more attention to your diet when you're on a back shift because of the fact that you might make different decisions when you're tired than you would make if you had plenty of sleep. So maybe meal planning when you're on working back shift so that you, this is the time where you know you're going to have your meals planned. So you're not going to the vending machine or out with friends and making different food decisions.
Yeah. And you mentioned being tired. Of course, we're going to be tired trying to push our bodies to do this. And that leads to a lot of caffeine consumption. Is there a safe level for us to consume?
Again, caffeine is one of those that certain people cannot consume it. You probably know if you're one of those people that can't consume caffeine, because if you take one drink of coffee, your heart probably starts pounding and you don't feel well. So you probably already know if you can't consume coffee. And if that doesn't happen to you, you're probably not one of those people. So if you're one of those people that can drink caffeine pretty easily and you don't have a response to it, they say the tested upper limit is about 4 or 5 drinks per day of caffeinated beverage, which it's about 300 milligrams. We don't have any tests for clinical trials. So this is all anecdotal and based on self-report, where we ask people to self-report how much they drink, and then we look at the outcomes. So they're not a hard and fast rule, but certainly you may want to consider cutting back if it's more than 4 or 5 cups a day.
How about the timing?
Yeah, you really don't want to drink it close to bed if you can, especially for optimizing that sleep, particularly as you're aging and it's harder for you to get sleep. It's important to think about getting all your caffeine before about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, assuming you're going to bed around 10 o'clock. You know, you want to give a good 8-hour window to get the caffeine metabolized and out of your body.
I don't have good research on this, but it seems like we have a lot more people these days who are intolerant to foods, whether they're, you know, trying to eat a gluten-free diet. Obviously, lactose intolerance is a big one. What does that mean? And what is a way to really know that you are intolerant to a food?
Yeah, we're starting to learn more and more about food intolerance, and not just not like celiac disease. You know, obviously having celiac disease means you can't touch gluten, but we're starting to learn that some people may not have celiac disease, but if they eat gluten enough, they still don't feel well. They might feel like they're having bad allergies or just a little bit run down. So they cut back on gluten and they feel better. Those food sensitivities are your gut not responding to the food as if it were food. It sees the gluten, or some people have dairy allergies. That's to the protein, the whey and the casein in the dairy. When your gut sees those proteins, it thinks of it like an allergen, like pollen or allergies that people have from seasonal allergies. And it mounts an immune response to those foods, which makes you not feel so great. The way to know if you have one, you can get really expensive, fancy tests done, or you can just do what's called an elimination diet. Cut dairy out of your diet for 3 weeks. Don't eat it at all. See how you feel. Add it back in. See how you feel. Just self-experimentation, and you can see if you were sensitive to that particular food. Gluten and dairy, so, you know, basically breads, flours, and dairy are the two most common. But some people also have insensitivities to like nightshade vegetables, eggplant, tomato. You may notice some food sensitivities. Basically, it's trial and error to see if you really have that insensitivity or that sensitivity, or if it might be something else.
Are there any foods we should avoid entirely?
I don't actually think there are any foods you need to avoid entirely. I think there are only foods you have to be careful with, you know, limiting alcohol, limiting caffeine. If you personally don't feel great when you eat dairy, limit dairy. But no, I think all foods are safe in moderation. And the evidence really shows that humans have adapted to have, you know, widely different diets across the world, depending on the types of food that are available. We're actually lucky in that way. We can eat so many different types of food and still, you know, maintain health. The key is not overeating any one specific thing.
Okay, so I'm happy you said you can eat anything, because I have the biggest sweet tooth.
Me too.
Feel like I need dessert after every meal. So if we are going to eat dessert, when is the best time to eat it? And how do we combat the sweet tooth?
I mean, my favorite time to eat it is before I eat any other food, because I'm like you, I love sweets too. But the best time to eat it is usually at the end of the meal, after you've already filled up on your fruits and vegetables and your fiber. Try to get a ton of fiber in before you eat that sweet treat at the end. And then try to keep it to reasonable size, you know, split a piece of cake three ways, because you go out for dinner and get a piece of cake and it really is like a 1500 calorie piece of cake. So it's better to split with people. Keep any small little, you know, treats that you like chocolates or something like that. And you can have one of those afterwards. Try to switch to less sugary alternatives. You know, one of the things that Europeans do so much better than Americans, their desserts are not nearly as sweet as ours. We put so much sugar in our desserts. So if we can, you know, cut back and try dark chocolate instead of milk chocolate, that can help. But certainly restricting yourself altogether will just make you miserable.
You talked about fad diets being a money-making business. Another area that seems to be that is vitamins and supplements. Is there any universally that you would recommend or that we stay away from?
Yeah, I always recommend vitamin D. We do not get as much sun as we used to, and we all wear sunblock, and that's great, you know, in preventing skin cancer, but it's not great in terms of producing vitamin D, because we evolved to produce vitamin D in our skin, and even an SPF of 8 is going to block that vitamin D conversion in your skin. So vitamin D is one that people need, particularly in the winter, to think about. Vitamin B12 is one that vegetarians often need. So if you're consuming a vegetarian diet, you might want to take a look at B12. Fish oils are the third one, I would say, especially if you're not consuming a lot of nuts like walnuts that have the same types of fats in them that fish oils do. So if you're not eating fish, you're not consuming nuts, fish oil is a really good supplement to consider. And then after that, the rest of them, you know, do you need them? Do you not need them? They're good insurance if you have an unhealthy diet, but really you can get all the vitamins you need from food. We have a joke in the nutrition field that vitamins are a really good way to have expensive urine, because for the most part, they're just going to come right out of your body. Again, as an insurance, they're pretty cheap insurance if you want to take a multivitamin and you know that you're on back shift and you're not eating as healthy as you want to eat. A multivitamin can be a pretty good insurance package.
What about pre and probiotics?
Pre and probiotics are kind of a different category all to themselves. They're also a supplement, and we're learning so much about the gut and how much the gut needs. Prebiotics are basically fiber. So they're essential. They should be a part of your diet. You need that insoluble fiber that's going to make it into your colon that the bacteria can eat. That's basically what a prebiotic is. It's just a type of carbohydrate that can make it into your colon and the bacteria can live off of it. So make sure you're getting lots of fiber, potentially even a fiber supplement like psyllium, flaxseed, chia seeds. Those are all really great bulking agents to, you know, make it all the way into your colon and feed those bacteria. Probiotics are the actual bacteria themselves. So prebiotic, that's the bacteria food or the fiber. Probiotic is the bacteria itself. And you can get those in pills. You can get those in yogurt, sauerkraut, kefir. There are lots of different fermented foods that have probiotics in addition to the pill. Do you need them? After you've taken an antibiotic, it's a good idea to take a probiotic to repopulate your gut. But in general, you probably do not need a probiotic supplement unless you're starting to notice a lot of issues with, constipation or diarrhea or gut pain, gas, then you may want to consider if a probiotic would help you.
Another buzzword we have thrown around a lot is the word detox. We have detox juices, detox pills, cleanses like the Master Cleanse and things. Do we actually need to do things like that?
You don't need to. Your liver is perfectly capable of detoxifying your body without any help. You know, that said, I'm not going to lie and say I've never done them. I love a good detox just like the next person. As I've gotten older, I've realized it's probably just cutting out caffeine and alcohol for 3 days. It probably is not the juice or whatever else I'm doing. It's probably just the activity of minimizing alcohol, caffeine, and other foods. Maybe it's the gluten, maybe it's the dairy, who knows? I know that when I've done these things in the past, I do feel better at the end of the 3 days. And I will always go back to that. If something makes you feel better and the science isn't there, oh, well, go for it.
You talked about gluten-free a lot, lactose-free. Are we seeing an increase in allergies or are we just noticing more?
We are seeing an increase in allergies and autoimmune diseases. And really, I kind of see allergies and autoimmune diseases as very similar in terms of what's going on in your body. Basically, they're both conditions where your own immune system attacks something it shouldn't, whether it's your own body or this food that you're consuming, or pollen in the air, whatever it is, it's your immune system overly ramping up and making you feel not so good. One clarification we to talk about with milk. With milk, when you have a milk allergy, you're allergic to the protein itself. You're not allergic to lactose. Lactose is a sugar in milk that some people lack the enzyme to digest. And so they have to take either lactaid to get the enzyme in there or not consume lactose at all. So they're actually two very different conditions, the milk allergy and lactose intolerance. Lactose intolerance can be treated with the enzyme, but a milk protein allergy cannot. You know, we're definitely seeing a rise. We're seeing a rise in peanut allergies in children. What's happening with the immune system? It's a big debate in science currently. There are people that argue that we don't have enough access to pathogens. So our lack of access to pathogens is making our body overreact to things that it shouldn't. There are people that want to give everyone parasitic infections to cure all these things, but we really don't know what's causing it, but they are on the rise.
As nurses, we kind of have this culture of, you know, neglecting ourselves so we can care for others, as if that's the approach that we should do. What's one thing that you would like us as nurses to prioritize in our own health?
You know, this is a very, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have said your diet. Today, I would say your mental health. You know, take 5 minutes a day to meditate, to listen to music you like listening to put yourself in that headspace where you're calming your parasympathetic nervous system down and giving your body a chance to, you know, to process what's there. Maybe it's detoxing your brain. I'm not sure what happens, but I think that idea of consciously taking some time to de-stress every day. Nurses are on the go. You know, nurses are moving from person to person. You're internalizing other people's pain all the time because you're treating them. You're trying to help them to feel better. And at the same time, you're getting bombarded with the constant stress of that. So I think finding a way to reduce the stress so that you have the headspace to make other good, healthy decisions, like what you're going to eat, how much sleep you're going to get, whether or not you're going to work out. All of those things can then follow suit.
We do have a question we like to ask all of our guests. What is your definition of a nurse?
Oh, my definition of a nurse. It's probably quite silly, but it's someone that cares for other people. Whether that's, it's not just, you know, physically in terms of, you know, when you've got wounds or you're ill, but just caring for the needs of someone else.
Dr. Jett, thank you so much. I know everybody's going to enjoy listening to this because we certainly have, and we've had so many questions answered by you. Whenever you're on our leadership calls, you're definitely the one we hear that we want the most back. Everybody enjoys having you, and you get flooded with questions, and doing all this on the fly is so impressive. So we just thank you for investing in all of us today.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm happy to be on anytime.
So that was a lot to unpack.
Yeah, that was incredible. She is so quick. I took a lot away from that one.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Judd as much as we have, and we can't wait to be with you next time on WellNurse.